You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Reclaiming Americanism with Alon Giorno, Jonathan Honig, Ankar Gatte, Gregory Salmieri, and Yaron Brook.
I'm Alon Giorno. I work at the Ayn Rand Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to this lunch panel titled Reclaiming Americanism. We hear the term Americanism used a lot, and it's used in a positive sense often, but there's astonishingly little understanding of what that term is. And there's little understanding of what's distinctive about America and its political system and what's good about it. And this is compounded by real misunderstandings and distortions of what America is and what Americanism is about. So a recent book, which I hope you've all heard about, and if not, this is it. It's called A Textbook of Americanism. Sets out to present Ayn Rand's view of this. It includes an essay of hers from 1946, and it identifies her distinctive conception of Americanism. And then in addition to that, as we'll hear in a moment, the book includes contributions from other writers and scholars building on Ayn Rand's view and applying it and relating her view to contemporary issues. So I want to introduce the panel. And then we'll hear a bit about the book, and then we'll start into some conversation, and I'll leave some time for questions from you, because we'd like you to be involved and engaged in the topic. So let me introduce our panelists today. I'm delighted to have with us Jonathan Honig. He's the, He is the editor of the book, and he is sort of the driving force that got this whole project off the ground and to completion. He's an investor, and you've probably seen him on Fox News Channel. He's often there commenting. Next to him is Yaron Brook. He is executive chairman of the Ayn Rand Institute. He is the chairman of the Ayn Rand Institute. And, of course, the host of the Yaron Brook Show. Still doing that? Okay, good. next to him is Dr. Ankar Gatte, a senior fellow and chief philosophy officer at the Ayn Rand Institute. And here is Dr. Greg Salmieri, a philosophy fellow at the Anthem Foundation and an instructor at Rutgers University. Now, all of us on the stage... Oh, yes, go ahead. Sorry. we are each contributors to the book, but let's hear about the book. So I've asked Jonathan to give us a walkthrough a bit about the background of the book, what it contains, what's so special about it, and why don't you walk us through the presentation, Jonathan? Thank you.
Thank you, Alon, and thank you all for being here, and thank you all especially for your support of these ideas in general, and specifically for your support for the Ayn Rand Institute, who are advocating for your ideas and these ideas every day, literally all across the world. Gonna take kind of a light topic today, something someone's not too passionate about, you know, America, something that all of us, and as I've found and discovered, the more I've been out there with this book, everyone from every political stripe is extraordinarily passionate about. And everyone thinks that he or she knows exactly what is this country ultimately about? What are the principles on which it was based? And kind of probably most importantly for our purposes, does America reflect that today? Well, a quote from a new textbook of Americanism. I don't think it's a nice term, Trump said, of American exceptionalism. I don't want to say we're more exceptional because it's to say we're more outstanding than you. Well, I believe, and I think Ayn Rand would also say, that we are more outstanding than you, or our America is more outstanding. The problem is people don't know what it is anymore. What is Americanism? Is it buy America, hire America? Is it I am my brother's keeper? This is the political choice in America now, in effect, nationalism or socialism. But it's a false choice. It's a false choice. America's foundational principle. I've given a few talks for student audiences, and I have to kind of put it in when I say the secret sauce, if you will, is individual rights. That is what makes America special, unique, important throughout history, and important to this day. That is truly the secret sauce that we need to reevaluate, we need to reestablish, and we need to reclaim, as we said, as objectivists and as Americans. And Ayn Rand is America's philosopher. This, I think, is what's so frustrating to me as an objectivist, as I see how Ayn Rand is portrayed, especially for young people in the media. You know, what is that perception of Ayn Rand in the media? It's kind of this dark, you know, gloomy. This is exactly contrary of what we as objectivists know Ayn Rand truly to be about. So part of what I've wanted to do with this project is replace that and remake the connection that Ayn Rand is America's philosophical voice. She is America's philosopher. And you all know her life story. This group, more than anyone, doesn't. You need to be reminded of her true American success story. We want to talk about, you know, the American dream, and Ayn Rand not only, I think, embraced it, she defined it. And of course, she came here in 1926 to be free to be able to write. But as we know, she saw that same sort of collectivism growing here in America. Her answer, and what many of you probably don't even know, was a project called Textbook of Americanism. And as Alon mentioned, this was a project started way back in 1946, upwards of, 75 years ago, in a publication called The Vigil. And in effect, we think of Hollywood as being exclusively left-wing. I don't think left and right even matters anymore, but let's just say a group of individualist-oriented, anti-totalitarian Americans in Hollywood organized a group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. And these were all the top stars of the day, Ginger Rogers, Gary Cooper, and many others. Now, I want to recommend highly Robert Mayhew's book about called Ayn Rand and Song of Russia, which talks all about not only the Motion Picture Alliance, it's really a fascinating, Ayn Rand's life is fascinating, but the history of the kind of drama of this group, of this period in her life is not to be missed. So I'd absolutely recommend that in terms of learning more about this era. Her goal with Textbook of Americanism was to educate producers, educate the public about what she observed and understood as communist motion picture propaganda. She proposed 12 questions and only, excuse me, she proposed 41 questions. Only 12 of them ultimately were answered. Wait for it, until now. Because truly, thanks to most importantly, the Ayn Rand Institute, thanks to Dr. Peikoff, the estate of Ayn Rand, thanks to the Prometheus Foundation, and all of you in the audience, supporters of these ideas, supporters of the Institute, we now have a new textbook of Americanism. This comes at just the right time, because I would put forth that these ideas, trying to decipher what Americanism really is about, it's up for grabs even more than it was, I think, probably when Rand started the project in 46. And her purpose was in a sense to provide kind of an everyman's guide. This wasn't going to be a scholarly textbook about, getting into deep metaphysics and epistemology in America. It was going to be a basic everyman's guide to understanding what America's true fundamental principles are and are all about. So here's how a new textbook of Americanism is outlined. The first part is, in my opinion, the best part. And of course, that's Ayn Rand, her original textbook of Americanism. And she starts not with, talking about political parties. She doesn't say, well, what's better for America? The Whigs or the, I don't even know, who was it that? She talks with basic fundamental principles. This is the genius of Ayn Rand, even at this relatively early stage in her careers. She starts with that basic issue. She says the basic issue in the world today, Dr. Brooke has said he envisions it as being in the political realm. I think I've heard you mention that before, and it's so true. The basic issue is between these two fundamental principles, individualism and collectivism. And these two principles are at the opposite of two social systems. So this is a great book for young people, especially, who just simply have not been introduced to these ideas at all. They've been told since day one, you're going to have to sacrifice for someone. And maybe in the back of their mind, there's some sense of, gee, America, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. I kind of heard that somewhere, but what does that have to do? This is the book that makes that understanding of Americanism and individualism clear. And Rand, she has got the shortest essays in the book. So it shows you how astute this woman was and concise she was with words. She goes through what is a social system, compares individualism and collectivism, United States on one hand, and boy, plenty of other nightmarish collectivist societies on the other. What is a right? The inalienable rights of man. How do we recognize another rights? Again, really easily accessible, short essays. as Rand envisioned them, something that an everyday person, if you will, could just thumb through and find some real answers that confer with these basic American principles. Is the greatest good for the greatest number a moral principle? These are the basic fundamentals that are it's the stuff we debate every day on cable news. So they're still being asked and not correctly answered today. Part two expands Rand's original textbook of Americanism. So Rand answered those first 12 questions, and an astute group of philosophers associated with the Institute help answer the second portion of the additionals. Ankar talks about what is capitalism. I make the point of estate tax and the importance of property rights. Andrew Bernstein talks about communism and fascism. Is there any difference of that? And Dr. Bernstein is also a wonderful writer. He answers the question, are dictatorships efficient? And he answers very astutely, yes, they are efficient at mass murder, of course. You know, this is a really straight to the point type of reality-based gut check that makes so much of Rand, I think, objectivism so powerful and effective. Dr. Salzman, Richard Salzman, talks about how capitalism create, how fortunes are made in capitalism, outlines some of the heroes of today and of yesteryear as well. Amy Peikoff talks about racism and why racial prejudice is un-American. Ayn Rand asked that back in 1946. Gregory Salmeri makes the point about voting. And even today, I've given spoken in front of many college kids, and you know, you say to them, what makes America great? We can vote. We have the right to vote. And Dr. Salmieri makes the point, you know, that is that idea that America and voting is, that's really America's defining principle. That's what paved the way for the promotion of democracy in the Middle East. And the whole idea of this fantasy to make the world safe for democracy that has, in my opinion, led us into a lot of very unfruitful wars. The third part is, If Ayn Rand's original is the best, this is right there behind it. This is really the goal. This is the unpublished commentary of Ayn Rand that's been available for the first time thanks to the Ayn Rand Archives and the Ayn Rand Institute. So back in the late 60s and early 70s, Ayn Rand held a series of very informal workshops, basically where students of hers, students of philosophy, got together and shot it, you know, and these young people peppered her with questions and asked her about all types of topics, ranging, as we'll see, from, you know, should there be a government, should there be a world government, which is very much in question today, and to issues about vaccination and quarantine. This is brand new material. It's never been published right here for the first time, all about these basic American issues. Is there a right to secede? How do we delegate to, what power do we delegate to a proper government? Interesting ideas. And again, the reviews have been tremendously positive about this never before seen material. The fourth part takes us a step further, Americanism and why it endures. Oftentimes, you know, when and we're really the outsiders now, right? I mean, we're the radicals, are the objectivists, are the individualists. People say, oh, American individualism, that old chestnut, get with the picture. Dr. Brook makes the point, Americanism is an enduring politics. He connects it to issues today like free speech, education, environmentalism, nationalism, obviously, which is kind of top of mind in our own political discussion now. Nationalism has become very much in vogue. Dr. Brook makes the point that Rand saw the essence of America as contained in the ideas that created her, not obedience, but reason, individualism, and freedom, and not statism, not that collectivism, you know, pledge to the Fuhrer. And of course, nationalism is growing in popularity. So these are popular ideas that need to be discussed. And most importantly, Ayn Rand's perspective needs to be continued to be brought to the table. Bradley Thompson has a wonderful theory. You know, when someone asks you probably, are you an you say, I'm an individualist. They say, oh, you're so selfish. I had one person on TV say, oh yes, America is too individualist now because we're all on our phones. We're all on our phones the whole time. There's just even a sense of what individualism ultimately is like. C. Bradley Thompson makes the point that it doesn't mean that we live on these islands by ourselves. That's what creates that freedom, that cooperation as Americans to deal with each other. Dr. Harry Binswanger, who's in the audience, graciously has contributed and updated his seminal essay, which couldn't be even more in vogue now, Why Buy American is Un-American. This is a tremendously hot topic. And in fact, national policy is being shaped, in my opinion here, on this very immoral and premise, this very un-American premise, that it's our duties to somehow buy Americans. So Dr. Bingswanger answers that in really wonderful detail. Ilan Giorno talks about one of his expertise and one of his specialties in terms of American foreign policy, obviously, as America weighs potential crises and attacks in the Middle East. This is coming to the forefront once again. And in fact, New Ideal, which if you don't subscribe to from the Ayn Rand Institute, you should, put this his piece out for all to read and enjoy without even having to buy the book. So of course you're gonna wanna buy the book, but Ilan really gets to the heart of what a true American foreign policy should be. So look, our kids, you're buying your kids these textbooks and they're costing you hundreds of dollars. This book is $19. It's a bargain, especially considering what's in it. And especially considering what they're reading all these, you know, very expensive textbooks. And what's the result? Is that young people are getting more and more interested, invested in socialism. They're just not being given the alternative. When I first read textbook as a young person, the light went off to me. I really saw the connection between America, Ayn Rand, of course, and individualism. That's the connection that we need to make. And Textbook of Americanism, now updated, a new textbook, does it in a really important, precise way. So let's reclaim Americanism, people. It's based on individualism. Let's quit it with this. Oh, I'm on the left, I'm on the right. Those labels do not matter anymore. Neither the left nor the right reflect true Americanism. So we need to advocate, in my opinion, for the right ideas. That's part of what we're doing here, not political tribes. And let's continue to make the point that Ayn Rand is America's philosopher. She is the American voice. She understood what America's about, and that's what's in this new book. Thank you all very much for being
here. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan.
I should mention
one thing about the book. So you said it was $19.99. Is that what you said, the cost of the book? Well, it's actually available here at the conference. There's a limited supply, and they're discounted from that retail price, and there'll be a book signing. So if you're interested in the book, and we're going to try to convince you that you should be over the course of the discussion. You wanted to add something, Yaron?
Yeah, let me just say, I don't think we've given enough credit for Jonathan for what he's achieved here. He mentioned this idea to me, I don't know, 10 years ago over dinner in Chicago.
We need the mic on.
Not on. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. No, Mike.
Try the switch.
No,
it's on.
Why don't you try this?
Mike is on. 1, 2, 3.
Is this one on?
1, 2. Oh, there we go. All right. Thank you. So I don't think enough credit has been given to Jonathan for the achievement here. I mean, he mentioned this to me, that he wanted to do this project 10 years ago. He has since engaged in rounding up cats, which is what objectivist intellectuals tend to be. Editing the work, finding the experts to edit the experts, putting it all together, and now is a tireless marketer for this. So he had the vision, he executed, he's marketing it, and he's driving all of us to market it. So, you know, congratulations, Jonathan, a huge achievement here.
Thanks, Yaron. So I wanted to start, and I'm going to open this particularly to you, Onkar and Greg, with a sort of a wide-angle question about Americanism. What makes it an ism? Where does it originate from? What are its philosophic roots? And then relate that to how Ayn Rand thinks of Americanism. What's distinctive in her conception?
Well, America's the first and only positive a country that was founded on a philosophy, on an ideal. There are a couple of others that were, but the ideals were murderous and weren't good. But it's the country of the Enlightenment. It's the country that was founded on individualism. The Enlightenment ideas, individualist ideas, were percolating in Europe. It was a European phenomenon having an Enlightenment. But there it was fighting with centuries of tradition, an ancient regime. There were gradual reforms and some revolutions in Europe, but America was a country that was fresh. The people here were all people who'd come here to start and find a better life. They were all colonists, immigrants, people who moved here in search of something better, different ideals that they had, some of them good and some of them bad, but people who were willing to make the move to make their lives better. And the children and, second generation children of those people living here. It was a place where these new ideas of the Enlightenment could take root, and in a context where people were able to think about, well, what kind of life do we want to live, fresh, where there wasn't a whole lot of tradition bogging them down. And the United States of America is the country that was founded on the ideas of the Enlightenment, on the ideas of reason, of individualism, of government being there to protect each person's right to pursue his own life and happiness, as first articulated by European philosophers like Locke, and then further articulated and implemented by Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Ben Franklin, the framers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And as a result of that, it's the country of capitalism. Capitalism also, in a way, began in Europe, particularly in England, but it really took off here, where there was a new form of government, a new way of life, and a population that was looking for something new, that thought of themselves as a young country that was just forging its identity. And that idea of individualism, of a government that supports individualism, and then a way that people become organized economically in that context, of each pursuing their own values and creating things on a grand scale, each feeding the other's achievement, is something that happened in America and spread from America to much of the rest of the world. Imperfectly, always imperfectly instantiated here, and more imperfectly instantiated in other places. But for the first time happening here, and it brought the world out of misery and poverty. And that's what Americanism is.
I won't say much. I agree with all of that. Just want to emphasize that the part of what it means that we're putting an ism to it is it's a doctrine, and what you get, Ayn Rand insisted on this, and it's easy to forget this, that the principle of individual rights is a radically new principle. It's for the first time in history, they figured out what it looks like to properly subordinate might to right. And that's the central question in political philosophy. And it was finally figured out. And what America is the implementation of that answer in concrete form. And that's the reason it becomes a model. To the extent that it becomes a model, what it's modeling is how to subordinate might to right. And when you get that even halfway right, what you get is an enormous freeing of the individual and enormous productivity. And that's what you see around the world, even if it's, as Greg said, it's impartially instantiated. But to the degree it is, you have a radically new principle that's becoming a model. It's the birth of the capitalist Western world, really.
So we're going to talk a bit about the contemporary scene in a moment, but I want to just rewind a bit. So Ayn Rand wrote this essay in 1946. So she was moved to defend Americanism 60 plus years ago, right? So help us understand what was the context back then. What were the forces? How would you characterize the attacks on Americanism? Who were they? Who was doing that, and what was the nature of that? Well,
with Shoshana Milgram and other true historians of Ayn Rand in the audience, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but. In terms of kind of evaluating the scene back then, that it's really not the focus of the book or really my area of expertise. But the question she laid out, I think, to me, as I come at it from the modern day perspective, they're truly even more relevant today. They're the questions that we're still asking today. And what's so interesting about this project is that it was completed obviously before Atlas Shrugged. Mm-hmm. So we can see oftentimes kind of early elements of, in my opinion, some ideas that were later better codified and fully fleshed out in her work. I'll just defer to Ayn Rand, to Robert Mayhew's book, Ayn Rand, A Song of Russia, which sketches out everything that was going on in that period in that history.
A word or two about it, though, again, about just who she was responding to. So I forget just what year the following anecdote is from, whether it's a little before or somewhat after this textbook was written, but it gives you a sense of the cultural atmosphere and her response to it. There was a lot of anti-fascist activity in Hollywood, as they called itself then. Anti-fascist groups, anti-fascist organizations, parties, and she was invited to one or to contribute to one. And her response is, I'll join it when it's also an anti-communist society, not before then, comrade. So there was the idea that among the intellectuals in America, a hatred of, or a recognition of, or a playing on the evil of fascism, which a lot of the population recognized, and a using it to sell communism, to present communism as the alternative. And she was rejecting that. And that's why the idea is the fundamental issue in the world today is individualism versus collectivism. Collectivism, whether it takes the form of the fascists or Nazis, or whether it takes the form of Lenin and Stalin. And I think we see that alternative more and more again today, kind of socialism versus non-socialist forms of authoritarianism and collectivism.
And part of it, part of what's going on is collectivism has just been defeated on the battleground, in the physical battleground in World War II, and she views it even in a sense defeated in the Soviet Union because it's poor and it's dying and people are dying, and it's obvious at this point that collectivism should just go away because it's just being crushed by the only capitalist or the remnant of capitalism in the West. And yet it's still alive and well in the minds of the intellectuals and the intellectual class. And it's still the dominant intellectual idea, even though we just won this war. And I think that contradiction is part of what motivates it. This is it. This is now an intellectual battle through and through. This is about ideas. She says something about, collectivism is dead. Of course, it's not intellectually, but it's dead in the sense that it's just being crushed. It's killing people. That's all it does.
I would add to that, though. So I agree. She thinks it dies in World War II, but it's intellectually and existentially the capitulation to it. So if you think what happens at the aftermath of World War II and how much of the world is handed to Soviet Russia, that is such a calamity. And if you had anywhere close to like a halfway decent ideological perspective, you would never have done this. And the fact that the US government can do this tells you how bankrupt ideologically we were.
So let's turn to the contemporary situation we find ourselves in. I want to set up what I've seen a lot of. So there's two views of Americanism in the culture, not only, but these two are really prominent. And it's almost as if people are talking about a different country. So on the one side, you hear, and maybe this will resonate with some of you, that America is stained with sin down to the bone, is an immoral society, it's shot through with oppression and prejudice, and wherever we go around the world, we're the main cause of conflict and chaos and empire, extending our empire. So anyone heard that kind of view? I mean, you have to just, I've been on college campuses lately, I hear that a lot from students. So that's one view of what America is and represents. And then another kind of view that people have is partly in response to that, they're waving the flag, they're for America. But what they are for is this idea of America as a white, principally Anglo-Saxon and religious, particularly Christian society. So, not, so this WASP kind of mentality. So on one hand, there's America can do nothing right. It's the source of all things wrong. And the other side is America can't do wrong. It's sort of what we are for. So I think there are some issues there that are worth untangling. And how do you sort this out? Because are there things that America has done wrong that it has mistaken? And you said, Greg, that America's implementation of these ideas has been imperfect. But at the same time, is it right to think of America as some of these apparent defenders view it?
I see both of those views of America as really the same. Is this on? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
So I see both of those views of America as essentially the same. They're both an amoralist brute view of the country. We're a bunch of people who have some narrowly defined interest, no ideas are involved in defining or understanding what our interest is. No ideas are what makes us great or evil. We're just a bunch of people in power relations over other people. And then you have the one side that's cheering that on, go Team USA, and the other side that's against it. But without any moral content, So America's the greatest because it's the strongest and it can pummel other people, or America's the worst because it's the strongest and maybe it has pummeled other people, although I think that's a distortion of history. But not America's represents something. America's for freedom. What's great about America, what makes it strong where it's strong, is its freedom, is the ability of individuals to lead their own lives for their own sake. And where we don't have that, we should get it back or get it for the first time. Because there definitely have been evils. I mean, the obvious one, and it's massive, is slavery. But there have been many others, ways in which America has not lived up to its principles over time. And that doesn't all come from some one political faction in the country. There's been, every party is guilty, and most people are guilty of endorsing some serious contradictions to the principle of freedom. But those contradictions, those bad things, those evils, aren't unique to America, and they're not what made America powerful, and they're not what made America great. And we have to understand those as blights, things that we inherited. I said we didn't have many traditions, but there are some. Things that we inherited that we did not overcome and that we have to overcome.
So I'll quickly mention, Iran has observed in the past that just an increasing emotionalism in the political discourse writ large, I've certainly seen that as well. So I think there's a sense now, Ayn Rand was obviously a thinker. She put forth principles. But what I've observed, and maybe this is, to your point, on both all ends of the political spectrum, is just a dissatisfaction with kind of principles, qua principles, the sense of, we need action. What is it? What did a principle ever give us? What did that, we need to do something. Why do we stop with principles, even on the, as I said, the so-called right? So in my kind of advocacy, especially with young people, is getting to stop and answer, as Rand did again, some of these just basic issues, and then come back around to the kind of the modern day present applications, and that in terms of that they're more concerned about. But there's that, I think, just that emotionalist unhappiness with principles, this anger and readiness for action that makes this book so important right now.
So let me just probe one of the issues that came up that I'd like someone to address. Maybe you, Ankar, are interested in this. So what do you say to the people who argue, well, America was a Christian nation from its beginning, and you're happy, all this happy talk about the Enlightenment, yes, that's fine, but deep down, America was a Christian society, and that's what we need to get back to. I mean, I don't know if you guys hear this, but how do you respond to that?
Well, it depends who's saying it, but if you're talking about students, they're just totally ignorant, mm-hmm. And they've been brainwashed. And if they're brought up in a religious environment, it's a total distortion. So if you know anything about the history of the West and the religious wars in Europe, and the Protestants and the Catholics killing each other for decades and decades, the persecutions, that this was a major, major problem of what religion does when it gets political power. And part of the Enlightenment is struggling with this issue and trying to figure it out. And the answer can't be that you persecute religion, but nor can the answer be that you give religion political power. So how do you get an answer to this? And this is part of what the principle of individual rights solves. And this is part, Locke's interested in both the principle in a wide scale and particularly how it applies to church and state. And it is, you get a radical view when it is, a religion's just like a club. It's like a bridge club or a chess club, and it should be treated the same. And it doesn't have any special status. We don't have to persecute it. So America's the first to explicitly separate church from state. And for two ways, that the state should not be involved in persecuting religion, but we dare not let religion in its essence as faith dictate the power of government. So the idea that this is the founding of America, and then you're going to say, well, it's based because it's on Christianity. No, Christianity was part of the problem that they're trying to solve. So and they don't know anything. They don't know anything about political theory or political science or the history. So this is a massive failure of the university, not of the students. Mm-hmm. The students are just ignorant. Mm-hmm.
Well, they also are ignorant of the Old Testament. I always encourage them to go read it and find me any respect for the individual, any respect for rights, or any respect for religious freedom, or any respect for, for individual rights. It's just, it's particularly the Old Testament. That's the fun one. It's all about rape and pillage and slaughter in the name of God. And there's no accident that Christians later are fighting each other, because that's what they get from the Old Testament. That's directly they get from that. You know, if you're not worshiping the right God, wipe them out, kill them all.
And also just, I mean, read some late 18th century and early 19th century American texts, for Christ's sake, if you have are tempted to this view. I mean, Tom Paine, who's good on some things and bad on others, but he makes Christopher Hitchens look like a pious Catholic. I mean, the guy is so anti-religious in any conventional sense of religion. He's a deist, but he's so, I mean, he's pillorying the Bible with, and Thomas Jefferson was associated with him largely in the press and called an atheist because of it, which wasn't true. He still got elected in a pretty, I mean, it's the idea that this was a pious, devout nation belies just all the historical evidence in the first generation. There was a great awakening later, and there were periods where the country was very religious. But the founding period and the time directly after it, it was a period of a lot of disagreement about religion, including a lot of really radical anti-Christian, in the sense of mystical Christian religion, thought. So it's just, it's ahistorical. Read some good histories. I mean, and give them Gordon Wood, the creation of the American Republic. And there are histories of this time, and if you that cite all the primary sources, and it's not a pious, wholesome period. I mean, in some bad ways too. I mean, it was a time of great debauchery and libertinism.
Well, and there were real atheists among them. Maybe not in the funny fathers that we know, but in the background, there's a huge debate going on over religion, and there are real atheists who are advocating that are denouncing religion completely, and it's a very fertile intellectual time where people are really debating important ideas and struggling with those ideas.
So I want to raise one other issue that is I hear on college campuses when I talk to students, and that is the issue of race, and it's become even more prominent in the culture. And I think there are important issues to talk about. So at a conference we did, it was a year ago, 2 years ago, the Ayn Rand Con, that was one of the points of discussion. So I'm interested in your perspective on how to sort out, because as you said, slavery was one of the big moral stains in America's history. So how do you think about these issues now? Because the way I see it being discussed is, there are systemic forms of racism in American government, American society. It's ineradicable in some sense. That's sort of the view you hear. And in other ways, there's been real progress, and that seems like there's an appreciation for that. So how do you kind of evaluate the situation? Maybe we can go down along here, starting with you, Greg.
So I think, and we've had a panel at this at OCON too. Mm-hmm. I think racism is a really serious and enduring problem in America. There's been ways in which we've made progress on it. There are ways in which we've backslid on it. But I don't think it's something to brush under the rug. We're a society that's largely segregated by race, and I think for bad reasons. And if you look at just where people live and who's in what jobs and so forth, you can notice, you're looking around this hotel and so forth. It's not, there's something unhealthy about the way the society is racially stratified. And I think there are causes for that, and we should be thinking about what those causes are. I think largely what's happened in our history is that's been a cause that was co-opted by people who were America haters, to use as an excuse to damn America. And you can think of that if you go back into the 30s, I think it was the 30s with the Scottsboro Boys. This was like a case of some black men who were railroaded for a crime, and there was a lot of discontent about it. And the communists used it as a kind of rallying call, as though they weren't persecuting Jews and minorities in Russia in the most horrifying ways. But it's been something that's been taken up by the leftists and people, and from a long time ago has been. And the people who are anti-leftists, I think, have too often said what was wrong with what the leftists were saying, but have not said much about how do we get past this issue? How do we solve this issue? How do we implement individualism more fully in our laws, which have been discriminatory a lot of the time. The obvious ways are Jim Crow, even after slavery, but there are more subtle ones. The book, The Color of Law, is really useful on this point for people who are interested in it. And then culturally, I think of racism as, in a way, like altruism. You can, all of us as objectivists have thought about altruism, rejected it, said we're egoists, and yet you find many ways in which still there's some guilt or some altruistic thing coloring your thinking. And if not yours, you notice it in someone else. And he's a little bit too unassertive about this, and it's a legacy of altruism. And I think the same thing is true with collectivist attitudes towards race. There are kind of traditions or holdovers for it, or just ways of acting or patterns that have racist origins that you can notice in yourself or other people, and you have to correct them over time in the way that you do the remnants of altruism, even after you've intellectually rejected it. It's not something that just happens automatically. I mean, we were a society where it was illegal, for at least in large parts of this country, for white people and black people to eat in the same room 60 years ago. That's not a thing that just, well, we changed the law and then suddenly everyone's cool, right, the next day, and there's no legacy of that. That's not how premises work in someone's psychology. There are resentments about it on both sides, some with good reason, some with bad reason. There are all kinds of patterns of behavior, and it's something that'll take time to work out. I think in some ways it is getting better over time, but it needs sustained thought and attention about, like, where is this coming from? How can we fix it? What are the right responses? What's the properly individualistic way to deal with this issue? How do we raise children and raise this issue to the children in the right place? And I'm sure other things I haven't thought about, but it's something that requires thought, not just sloughing it off as, well, this is something the leftists use to beat up America. It's also something Americans need to think how to do better on.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I'll just note that because the people who have dealt with the issue over the last 60 years have all been, or in many ways have been collectivists, the issue has been dealt with wrong. So whether it's affirmative action, which is the wrong way to deal with the injustices that occurred before, or whether it's identity politics, which is the way the left now represents it, or the backlash now to identity politics, which I think is racism on the right, which I think is growing. I'm not one of those who thinks it's a myth of the left. I think it's there. I think it's growing. I think it's becoming more powerful. You know, you can ask me about what's going on in the conservative movement right now, but it's even among intellectual conservatives, you're seeing it bubble up to the surface. It really, really, really ugly. And I actually think it's getting worse. So while I think for many years, for maybe 50 years, things were getting better, but underneath the surface, there was something getting worse. And I think that has come out. And one of the, you know my position on Trump, so this won't be new, but I think one of the things that Trump has done is he's surfaced a lot of things that are under the surface. In terms of this particular issue. And what we can bring to it, what Ayn Rand can bring to it, is the right perspective, which is the individualist perspective, which is the only way to deal with the issue of racism. You cannot deal with the issue of racism by saying, I'm going to join this group, this clique, this tribe, in order to protect myself against the distortions of that other tribe. You're just playing into the racism. You're playing into the collectivist problem. And that's what I see the right doing, and you know, this issue I think is going to get much worse in the next decade or so, and we're the only voice. I see very few other voices out there that are talking in terms of individualism about it.
Can I just say one thing about the why we're the only voice? So in order to really solve this issue, even to start combating it, but to solve this issue, you need a positive alternative. And if you think, the way it will generally be put when people are trying to conceptualize it in a positive way, they'll go back to Martin Luther King's statement. I hope that my kids won't be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. The negative, what's going to go away, is they're not judged by the color of their skin. What does it mean to judge them by the content of their character? And if you preach in every university, in every science department in humanities, that we're determined, and even the best of the intellectual, like Sam Harris, Steve Pinker, telling everybody you're determined, what the hell is the content of your character? It's not under your control. Why are you being judged by that? What can you do about it? And this is the issue of free will is really, really important. It's not just a philosophical debate, that people really think of themselves and other people as having free will and a proper perspective. This is the control that I have over my life. This is the control that other person has over his life. And I'm going to judge him accordingly, and I'm expecting him to judge me. But it's judge and be prepared to be judged. That whole perspective is alien in the universities. And you can't get an individualist perspective in a positive way about this issue, absent having the right view on that.
The only anecdote to racism is individualism. The book has a whole essay by Amy Peikoff, in particular on why racial prejudice is un-American. But what I found, these gentlemen speak to far more students than I have, but what I found on all sides of the aisle is that, you know, from day one, these kids are fed, you know, racism and I affect, you know, you're part of this group and that group, you have, you know, you're this intersectionality between all these disparate groups, and that somewhat what gives you value. And so when I present these ideas, Ayn Rand's ideas to them, what I found is there's really an excitement. There's a thrill that they don't have to be part of these groups anymore, that there is another alternative. And that's, you know, that's the old saying, and all of us have experienced when we say, I read Ayn Rand and it changed my life. Just sneaking in that idea of individualism to a young person who's been given this, you know, racism and effects since day one can completely change their life. In this type of short format, you know, a less than 200 page book is a great entree, so that when people are taught, you know, America's a Judeo-Christian nation, or, you know, we're all tainted because of the history of slavery, this is a great anecdote to begin to for that transformation.
So I want to turn to another topic. So it's come up in your presentation, Jonathan, it's come up in the discussion so far, this idea of the left-right in the political scene. And I want to ask two questions, basically. One, maybe Ankar or Greg, you can summarize, what was Ayn Rand's view of this issue, both when she wrote Textbook of Americanism, and then later on in her writings on analyzing culture. And then I'll have a follow-up to that.
I'll just say a little bit about biographically Rand's views on it. So jump ahead to the 60s when she starts talking about these terms more and talking about concepts more. And earlier, there have been periods in her life where she thought of herself as a conservative. By the early 60s, she thought, I'm not a conservative. Conservatism is a movement I don't want any part of. She was very aware of and talked every time she used any of these political terms about the fact that these terms do not have fixed definitions. Everything in the political discourse is woozy and fuzzy because people aren't thinking in essentials. And therefore, you can't take any of these terms, conservative, liberal, left, right, libertarian, and kind of pin it to your masthead, and I'm part of this movement. They're all ill-defined, woozy things with shifting definitions as different sub-movements and groups come into the ascendancy, jostling for power in these cliques and in these communities. They're not really ideological groupings. And in light of that, she used the terms different ways at different times. So she would sometimes, for example, earlier on, occasionally use libertarian with a vaguely more positive sense. But she said, you know, you really can't count on this term because it's, like these other terms, apt to be taken over. And then, you know, when the libertarian movement crystallized, she started using it as a negative. Conservative, she wouldn't call herself a conservative after Eisenhower. And we could talk about why Eisenhower was a significant figure. But by then, see, there's not a conservative movement that I'm any part of. And it got worse and worse in the 80s. She viewed the conservative movement as, you know, a real evil. Left and right, there was a period in the 70s where she sort of super apologetically and briefly would say, well, you know, all these terms shift. For now, we can use the right to mean this casually and occasionally, and if we kind of bracket it and preface it. She was not saying the essential differences between right and left and we're on the right, but today all these terms are ill-defined and right vaguely means pro-capitalist for this 15 minutes, so I'll use right in this article. So there are times when she uses right and left that way. I think it was reasonable to do it in those handful of articles in the 1970s, but I don't think today the right means anything like pro-capitalist. I think it means 2 parts per million lower taxes than the socialists want, and 2 parts per million less regulations on certain businesses, but more on others, and then plus lots of other stuff out of the economic realm.
I'll just add one thing to that, which is you said they're not primarily ideological groupings. I think that's really important, that they're primarily, and I think for this has been for a fairly long time, primarily groupings of people who are connected by political party and things, some of the things they support, but it's not essentially ideological. It's essentially a group, or put it a little differently, a tribe. And tribes can shift. And part of what I think one's seen with Trump is how easily it's supposedly we stand for these ideas, but that was never the essential. The essential was I'm a member of this tribe. And now this tribe is saying, oh, we're supposed to do something different. And now when we don't like trade and we don't, oh, okay, well, I want to be part of this tribe, so I guess that's okay. And I mean, I don't have a high view of politicians, but I've been surprised by how easily they abandon. I thought they were a little more that ideas have some significance, or it's at least embarrassing to say that, oh, yeah, no, I don't believe any of that now. And that shows you how non-ideological it is. And then you have to ask, what is uniting it? And part of the whole phenomenon of tribalism is it gives you an explanation. And Ayn Rand gives you a deep explanation of what they find that is uniting them. And it's a psycho-epistemological uniting in a lot of ways. And that, I think, is how you have to understand these groups. Both. So not just the right, but the left as well.
So I want to raise a question with you, Yaron, and then Greg, because I think there may be some grounds of disagreement here. We'll see. It'll just be interesting to explore this issue. So I've heard you, Yaron, say... this might be an old view of yours. Maybe you've changed it, but at least 10 years ago, you would say things like, when I go to an event for a sort of conservative, right-leaning audience, I feel like there's more people there that I can win over. There's more better people there to be kind of brought into a better view. Whereas when you encounter sort of self-consciously left-wing or left-leaning people, or just as a movement intellectually, it's more nihilistic. So, is that your view? How am I characterizing it right? And what do you think of it now?
Yeah, let me just say something about the left-right thing first. There's certain concepts that are worth defending, fighting for, really fighting for, like selfishness, like capitalism. Right? I mean, it just doesn't mean anything. And it was always somewhat woozy, and it was always... So, yeah, there was a... good meaning wants to write in some sense, but it's just not that important of a term, particularly when we've got an alternative, which is individualism. We're pro-individualism, the rest are pro-collectivism, they're collectivists of the left and collectivists of the right, as people understand it. But I can't get excited about, I'm gonna defend the right, who cares? It's not a term that has meaning as a concept versus selfishness or capitalism that has all this good content underneath it that really needs preserving, and the word actually represents that content. Right versus left, I think we need to abandon completely. We should never associate ourselves with the right. We are not on the right. Given how the term is used in the culture, given who is on the right today, it is a travesty if we think that we are on the right and we communicate outside that we are on the right, because we're being bundled in with the worst collectivists, the worst types. And if you want to see this, I did my last podcast on this. I encourage you to go to First Things, which is a Catholic conservative journal, and read the latest controversy within the conservative movement and what they write about capitalism, what they write about individualism, what they write about American politics. I am not in a tent with those guys any more than I'm in a tent with Marxists. They're the same thing in my book. They want to destroy this country in one way or another, in different ways, but they're out to destroy this country. And there's a real battle going on right now within the conservative intellectual movement. And who wins that battle will determine what this right looks like. But neither side is very good. One is just pure evil, and the other one is just pragmatist, moderate, and it can't win. So it looks like the pure evil is going to win. So I hate to be pessimistic, but the conservatives are hopeless right now. 10 years ago, I would have said, yes, when I go in front of Tea Party groups or when I go in front of young conservative groups, they're at least seeking values. They look like they want to attain something. There's something positive that they're striving towards. And we have values, and we can attract more of them. Whereas many on the left are just out to destroy, they're out to knock down, and the haters, primary motivation is hatred. So that I thought that we could attract more people, and maybe we could at that time. It's really hard to track these things and actually have data on what works and what doesn't. But a lot of that, I've been very disappointed. I mean, I made a real effort with the Tea Party, and I think a lot of us made a real effort with the point, and it went nowhere. And in many ways, the Tea Party is now the Trump Party. There is no Tea Party independent of Trump, and I think Trump is a disaster, and I think they're buying into that disaster. They support that disaster. It's pure collectivism. They've given up on value. They've got some vague notion of what America is and where we're heading. And the emotion that's driving them is we hate the left so much and we hate where this is going so much. So we're willing to destroy everything. And you get this in these First Things articles. Mm-hmm. Anything, if the purpose is to destroy the left, anything goes. If we have to regulate high tech, then we regulate high tech. If we have to intervene in the economy, we intervene in the economy. If you have to have tariffs, we have to have tariffs. Whatever it takes to destroy the left, that tribe over there, we're in for, which is just as destructive as what the left has always advocated for. Now, I still think there's a difference in the sense that the right, and this is what makes, in my view, the right more dangerous and more threatening. And this goes back to the dim hypothesis, to Leonard Peikoff's dim hypothesis, which I, to the extent I understand it, I think I agree with. The right has a vision. The right knows where it wants to go. When you read the First Things articles, they want a theocracy. They want a type of theocracy. They won't admit theocracy, but they say, you can't just leave morality to the marketplace. It has to be, we have to tell people how to be, we have to do this. And look, a moral nation is a nation that serves God. And so if you don't serve God, it's not a moral country. And America was founded on Christian values and it served God. And they quote the founding fathers, in some distorted way to support this. They have a vision of what they want. They want a certain type of theocracy in this country. I don't think the left has a clue what they want. And I think that they primarily are still motivated primarily by hatred in that sense. And this is why they can't win. I really believe that the left in the end can't win. They'll win an election here and an election there. They'll do their stuff, but the American people will always rebel against that because they don't want destruction for the sake of destruction. They want an ideal that they think they can strive towards, particularly if the ideal is wrapped up in a flag and wrapped up with the founding fathers and wrapped up with America, with a distorted view of what America represents. That's what they want. And this is, again, part of my, I know a lot of you think I've got Trump derangement syndrome or something. Part of my anger and fury about Donald Trump is that that's where he's leading us. And I get passionate about this because I know what America is. I know this is why I came here. I know what America can be and what it represents. And he represents everything wrong with America. He represents this vision wrapped up in America first, wrapped up in a flag. And that's what makes it so ugly. At least the left doesn't wrap it in a flag. At least they don't pretend they love America. In a sense, I hate the people who pretend they love America and undercut it and distort it and fight against it and are going to ultimately destroy it more than the people who say, no, I don't like America. I want the United States to be Europe. Yeah, okay. So I know who I'm fighting. I know what the issue is. So that's the sense in which I think you're being. I think that the left is, the goal is nihilism to the extent they have a goal. I don't think they have one, right? I mean, even Elizabeth Warren says she's saving capitalism. And I think to some extent she believes that, right? But the right knows exactly, or at least certain elements of the right. I don't think Donald Trump knows where he's going. He's just a pragmatist. But the elements within the right that know exactly where they're going, and where they're going is, this theocratic authoritarian vision of America.
Let me, I basically agree with that. Let me add one or two thoughts. I do think we need the terms left and right, not to associate with one or the other, but as sociological terms to understand the country. Countries have, it's in the nature of politics that it fractures into coalitions of people who are, you vote for this guy or that guy, you have two people to vote for in the election, or if it's a parliamentary government where there are many parties, then they're still gonna faction and caucus together, and there's generally a shifting fault line where there are two coalitions that come together over groups of issues. And you need some way to note in your society at the time, well, who are the two teams? Who are the two sides? Even if I think they're both bad. If you think there's a real philosophical corruption in the country, in its politics, something that you need philosophers to solve, that there's a real deep thing wrong with it, then you can't think one of the two teams is right. I mean, if one of the two teams were right, then that would mean that half of the country basically understood the issues down to the fundamentals. And then we wouldn't be radicals. But we are radicals because we think the philosophy of the culture is deeply flawed. There's a lot wrong in it. And that can't be true. And the Republicans have basically got it right, or the Democrats have basically got it. They're both basically wrong. And they're two variants of the same wrong thing. but you have to understand the opposition between them just to understand what's going on in the country, and they feed off of one another. Now, which side is better? I don't think either. Which side can you reach more people in? Well, I think that has to do a lot with you and your skill set as much as with the people. It's not like everyone in the country is horrible. There are lots of people who are good or part good or have good and bad bits of them, and there are legitimate values drawing people to both sides of the political divide in the country today, and mixed up with wrong pseudo-nihilistic anti-values, and they get mixed in a very complicated stew. And some of us are better at appealing to one group of people than the other. It's a kind of skill you have to develop to understand this demographic and how I can pitch things to them. We have some advantage with the right in that for certain historical reasons, there's been some more regard for economic freedom on the right than on the left, although at this point there really isn't any, I don't think. And because of that in part and for some other reasons, there's been some more regard for Ayn Rand on the right and on the left. So it's easier to find an audience who's going to be interested in what we have to say, who comes with some positive associations and so forth. And so there's a way in which we've had a leg up with right groups that we haven't with left groups. But we've also, I think, worked harder at trying to reach those groups. And I think there's been missed opportunities with, if you look for not what are the best values of the best people who think of themselves as leftists, what things are they concerned about? Maybe secularism, maybe abortion rights, maybe fighting for things like scientific research on embryonic stem cells and things like that. If you think about the, or end of life decisions and euthanasia and so forth, if you think of what's driving people who are on the left on those issues, you'll find some bad people, but you'll find a lot of real values that are driving people. Just like if you speak to businessmen on the right who are concerned about regulation, mm-hmm. you'll find a lot of real values driving them. And I think it's a project for people at the Institute, for other objectivists who want to do cultural activism and outreach to do, to think about whether it's right, left, center, however the people identify themselves, what are groups of people who have some real value they're fighting for that we have something in common with, and we can try to reach out and deal with those people. I think there's been more success on the right with that in the past, but I also think there's been more trying on the right than on the left.
Yeah, just to add that I do think I'll work with Dave Rubin. I think Dave Rubin, certainly 3 years ago, and to some extent today, his audience has been secular, leaning left, or at least moving from the left. But generally, he didn't attract early on. Maybe it's changed today. But you know, conservatives or people on the right or religionists. And I think we've had terrific success with his audience. I know personally, just my first appearance on Rubin, the number of people that came have come up to me over the years and told me that. They never thought of reading Ayn Rand. They would have never considered reading Ayn Rand. So I do think there are lots of opportunities on the secular left, on the pro-science left. Mm-hmm. So not the kind of the nihilist left, but the pro-science left. The people who are attracted to the new atheists for a while. I think there's definitely a lot of opportunity among those people. And I think the stuff we've been doing with Dave Rubin, I think proves that.
I'll just quickly add, I'll echo what Yaron said in terms of divorcing ourselves, I believe, in Ayn Rand from that totally false left-right dichotomy. And I think, we are on the outside of that, and America is and was still on the outside of that, and really, really making that reinforcement as being important. What's so, I think, positive about this book and a great opportunity about this book is that, as often said, you need a little bit of a hook with people. You need to kind of hook people into understanding what makes individualism so important. And America is a great hook, because left or right, or everyone will say that he or she loves America, that they're passionate about it, and that they know what it's about. And what's so just powerful about this book, and like so much of Ayn Rand, is that you read an essay of Ayn Rand's, or something I'll mention again by Dr. Binswanger, explaining why Buy American is really un-American. Again, this is a kitchen table issue right now, and Dr. Binswanger's perspective is so kind of turns your head around and really makes you think in the new way, as so much of objectivism does. So I think, as all of us is trying to advocate for the ideas, don't be afraid to use elements of the book as a hook to introduce people to individualism, something that certainly if they're under probably 45, they've simply never even been brought to their attention before.
And what you want to be doing with that when you do it is saying, you're attracted to whatever you're attracted to. Let me articulate better and use Ayn Rand to what that is, what the value is there. And now that it's articulated, you're not finding it in this group. You're not finding it in this tribe. You're not finding it in this tract. You were into the right because you were pro-free markets. But the right isn't pro-free markets now that you understand what that is. So you've got to walk away from the right. Maybe you vote for some Republican candidate sometime, but you don't identify with them because what you're interested in is freedom, and you see that that's not there. Or you identify with the left because you hate racism and want to fight racism. But once you really understand what's wrong with racism, why it's proliferating in the country, you see the left, you know, a big part of what's causing it, and they don't have any alternative to it. So you've got to walk away from the left if you're anti-racist or if you're pro-women's right to abortion or whatever the issue might be, because they're not in any position to defend it, and they're not defending it. They're letting it slip away.
Well, I have a few more questions, but did you want to add something?
No, I was going to ask.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have more questions, but I'd like to hear what you guys have to say. Let's see. Raise your hands if you want to ask a question. I think we have first person in the back. Yep. Wait for the mic, please.
Can you hear me? Great, thanks. Okay, thank you. First time, I guess. I found it interesting that, you know, casting Americanism in terms of individualism, and which is very moralistic terms, and capitalism has been conspicuously absent from your discussion of this, which I think is important. I'm just curious, how new or differentiated is it to frame America in moral terms, both maybe for this group and maybe just maybe from a historical perspective?
I don't think it's new. I think that's what the Declaration of Independence does. It frames America as a shining new ideal, and it's the implementation of it. So what has been lost is the ability to understand what the Declaration means, and that it's about moral individualism. So we're one of the only people who will say the pursuit of happiness means the pursuit of your own happiness, not of everybody's happiness. We're not utilitarians, but the Founding Fathers were not. So it's reviving the moral perspective that created America. And our perspective on capitalism is that it is the implementation of these rights, so it's inherently moral. But that is not how most people think of it. And if Elizabeth Warren is saving capitalism, that's not how she thinks of it. Individualism is getting at the deeper root, so the root of the moral perspective, and nobody will defend it. So, and to get that this is what America is about, and so everybody's against this, and so you guys are saying everybody is against the American ideal, which is true, I mean, which is the issue today. So I think it is much, much effective, both in terms of communication, but it's because it's getting to the essence of the issue, that the issue is America is the country of the individual.
And if we can get that, capitalism becomes easier, right? Because what is capitalism? It's a system that protects the individual. So it's a system based on individualism. So it's not to reject one. It's just to build on the thing that's more foundational.
More questions?
I have the mic.
Okay, Jim.
I wonder if you'd help us distinguish these terms, Americanism and nationalism, a little bit more. So is Americanism, for example, just a species of nationalism? Is nationalism inherently collectivistic and Americanism inherently individualistic? These terms can get both conflated and confused. And when we speak about this, you could speak to someone about Americanism, and they might think what I think of nationalism. So can you maybe parse that a little bit?
Yeah, let me start with an anecdote from a children's cartoon and then say something about the concept. So there's a really lovely series made in the early 2000s called Liberty's Kids. It's a cartoon about the American Revolution, and it's one of the few relatively recent cultural artifacts that I think captures a lot of the American spirit and the founding spirit. I think people here, if you haven't seen it, you'd really like it. It's for children, but I love it as an adult, so look it up. The plot of it involves a number of young people living through the American Revolution. One of them begins as a Tory. She's a young woman. And she's coming around gradually to the American cause, the Patriots' cause. And one of the people who actually influences her in this is Benedict Arnold, who then turns out to be a traitor to the British, right? And she asks her friend, Benedict Arnold changed from America to the British. He's a traitor. Am I that because I'm now supporting the American revolutionaries and I was born in Britain? And the young man responds to her, no, because Americanism is an idea. Americanism is a, I don't think he uses the word principle, but it's an idea. And anyone who accepts these values, who wants to live this kind of life, can be an American and is an American. And so I think Americanism, as opposed to any variety of nationalism or patriotism, it's an ideology that other countries can adapt. And the world has become, not enough, but parts of the world have become a lot more American than they used to be. South Korea is pretty American. Hong Kong is very American. China is more American than it was under Mao, a lot more, although backsliding, right? So Americanism isn't about being attached to this nation as opposed to other nations. It's about implementing the principles that were first implemented in this nation and implementing them more fully. Now, as for nationalism, there's the word nationalism and patriotism. One shouldn't be a stickler about, you know, words are used somewhat differently by different people, and there's some optionality about which concept you associate with each word. But there are two ideas here. One idea is, in effect, my country, right or wrong. I was born on this soil. I associate with this tribe or this team. It's very important to me that we be a distinct unit as opposed to others, and that I side with our unit as opposed to others in any deal. I'm all about this group. And it importantly does not involve moral evaluation of the group. And there's another idea, which is you notice about the political community, the nation you're a part of, some of the ideas that animate it, some of the character that animates it, and you morally evaluate it as good. And then you're for that country because of your moral evaluation of it as good or as better than the alternative. So if you're an Israeli, say, take it outside of America, and you're pro-Israel, and you think Israel's being mistreated, is it just because you're some bigot who likes where you were born, and if somebody says against it, you're not going to hear any of it? And you would be the same thing if you were born in Russia or in the Palestinian territory or in Iraq or Iran? Or are you someone who thinks, well, here's what's good about Israel, not perfect, but better than these other countries around it, and that's why I'm for Israel? The latter thing is good, whether it's for Israel or the United States or any other country. If you're morally evaluating it, recognizing it as good, and then for the country, for its virtues, versus you're for the country because it's yours. And you can use the word nationalism for either of those two, or the word patriotism for either of those two, but I think the kind of history of it suggests that I think it's better to use the word patriot for the morally good one. That has a history in America of the patriots in the American Revolution, who I think were for America, for its virtues. And so I tend to use nationalism for the bad one. But I mean, Rand uses some interchangeably sometimes, and other people do.
I mean, she uses, if I remember right, she uses nationalism only in the context of foreign policy, of setting America's self-interest as first, in terms of what the U.S. government should be doing out there. I think in the context of the world in which we live in today, in the context of who is using the concept nationalism and how they're using it, I don't think we should use it. I think Greg is right in terms of what Americanism is as an idea. I think patriotism is a good thing, as Greg illustrated, if it's in your patriotic about a country and you the virtues of that country. But I would not use nationalism at all, given the way it's used right now. And it is very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have these arguments on cable news all the time. And as I interpret it, and these concepts are fluid on some level, but as today as it's commonly understood, as you know, nationalism is sacrifice to the nation. So are we about sacrifice or the greater good? No. So I think, you know, it's all for us, it should be all about promoting individualism, promoting capitalism. But that is what we stand for. And as Jerome mentioned, you know, Ayn Rand, it does not say my country right or wrong. It's my country for the right ideas. And those ideas, I think, that should be put first and foremost, not this notion that the nation is the value that we should all sacrifice for.
And if the issue is nationalism versus globalism, or what used to be called nationalism versus internationalism, which incidentally is a package deal that Rand wrote about in the Ayn Rand column, these are package deals. So
just spell out what you
things
mean.
Should it's there's not having to do with a nation versus having to do with the whole globe. There are a million different types of having to do with. Some things should have to do with everyone everywhere, and some things should have to do with a nation. So it's a good thing that there are different nations. We shouldn't all be under one world government or no governments at all in some kind of international anarchy. But there are certain things that national governments are good for and keeping nations distinct are good for, and others not. So we have laws. We have different laws in different countries. The country is here to protect the rights of the people in its country. There can form military alliances, and we use the military to protect one country from another. We have regions where we know where the jurisdiction ends and so forth. And all of that is done nation by nation, and it's right that it be done nation by nation. But who you can buy rice from shouldn't be that kind of thing. There's no reason why I should buy rice from a guy in South Carolina rather than a guy in China, and vice versa, the Chinese guy buying rice from America or somewhere else. So to the particular things that are being packaged dealt today is trade, movement of people, and who has governmental sovereignty. And these are being packaged together as, are you a globalist? You think all of these things should be internationalized all around the world and you don't believe in countries at all? Or are you a nationalist who thinks we should each be a tribe that trades only with itself, that doesn't, or views our trade relations with other countries as some kind of pseudo war, because you're an anti-conceptual mentality? And those things have to be broken apart.
Let's take a few more questions up here in the front, please.
She's coming.
She's on her way. Okay, so we'll take him next.
So keeping it in with the theme of the conference and this talk in particular, what's the role of romantic art in reclaiming Americanism? And did the decline of art lead to the decline of Americanism, or vice versa?
I mean, I think there's definitely a relationship. It's hard to articulate exactly what the relationship is and explain it, particularly in a short Q&A. But there's the art, I think, precedes is an important part of the culture and precedes decline and precedes, you know, rise. I don't think you have an enlightenment without the arts of the Renaissance. I think there's a relationship there between intellectual change and between the art that is being produced before. So there's an extent to which they're linked. As art has disappeared in America, or anything good has disappeared in America, there's a sense in which it declines. And yes, I think producing individualistic art, art that projects values that are individualistic, would ultimately help us ideologically promote the right ideas about America. What that art looks like, only an artist can tell us. And if it's too, you know, we don't want propaganda. Propaganda doesn't work, right? You want art. And there's a difference between propaganda and art, and there's a big difference. And there's some... There's a middle ground of you know, more propaganda, less art. I mean, there's all kinds. What we need is great art that is individualistic, and that's very hard. But that will be the first signs, I think, of real cultural change, where you can say, okay, in a few decades things will change, is when individualistic great art starts being produced.
And it's part of the incredible contradiction of the 19th century, that you have this enormously benevolent sense of life, most particularly in America, without knowledge of how to give this full expression. And it's the philosophy that stifles that. And this is part of her point about romanticism, that it cannot and does not portray a real hero, because a real hero from this sense of life is not an altruist. And the closest that you get with Hugo is he, and she comments on that, he cannot project a real hero, even the closest to Jean Valjean, Les Misérables. And she puts it, he's too much of an abstraction. And it's part of their retreat from dealing with the issues of the day. If you dealt with the issues of the day, you would, from a certain perspective, be enormously pro-individual, pro-America. Hugo is one of the few who will deal with contemporary problems, and not all his novels do. Les Mis does. It's injustice in the 19th century towards the lower classes. And in this sense, Ayn Rand is not just the philosopher of America. She's the artist of America. She has this American sense of life and knows how to portray it in art in a totally individual, first-handed way. But it's not an accident that at Atlas Shrugged leads people to love America and love capitalism. But it's because it's depicted in art in an enormously powerful way.
Add something that if you know a little bit about the history of 19th century art, romantic art, and particularly romantic music, nationalistic issues and confusions over them are all, I mean, you mentioned Sibelius earlier. I mean, Finlandia, right? And all of these 19th century romantic composers, or at least a lot of them, are returning to the folk music idioms of their particular countries. They're writing things that are seen as nationalistic. They get picked up later by nationalistic anti-rights movements in the country. And it's sort of ambiguous whether what they're doing, and it's particularly hard in music because it's evokes emotions without directly evoking concepts, of whether what's being celebrated here is the virtues of the nation in the patriotic sense, or whether what's being celebrated is the nation in the kind of tribal jingoistic sense. But this is the kind of thing that the romantic artists were dealing with and didn't know how to deal with. But it could be done right. You could have a novel that's patriotic in the deep sense, and I think Ankara's right, that we have the great American novel. And we're already in the period in one way where art is being done that's pro-American. It started in the with We the Living, but specifically with the Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And Atlas Shrugged is the great American novel. And it's already been making the world more American. America's a lot more American now than it would have been in this year if things had continued as they were going from 1956 on. We would have been to hell in a handbasket already. It gave us a reprieve through the 60s and 70s of a freight train headed towards an abyss. Not only Ayn Rand, but I think in huge part Ayn Rand, and in huge part both the philosophy and the art from it. And now that's where I think back to where we were prior to it having its effect. I mean, that we got a reprieve, and now we're back to intense capitalist hatred of capitalism driving both political parties. And I think that's what both parties are about right now, hatred of the individual. And it's up to us, those who understand that novel, who love it, who love America because of it, and who want to be her worthy lovers, to reverse the course.
So one last question here, and then we'll wrap up. Yes.
Thank you, Jonathan, and all of you on the stage for bringing this book to reality. It's a great value, and I loved it. Question for Yaron, please. You mentioned that you see a rise of racism among conservatives, and I wonder if you could give some examples.
Yeah, I mean, read the Manifesto on First Things. Sorry, read the Manifesto on First Things. And they talk about immigrants replacing Americans. Replacing. I mean, that to me is code word. And it's code word in Europe. It's what's the word in Europe? I mean, it's the idea that people, white genocide. It's all these. There's a whole set of these terminologies that are being used on the right to identify the fact that, you know, non-white people are coming into this country, and we're not going to be white now. Some of the authors of this document are not white. The guy who wrote the main article in First Things is an Iranian Catholic. I don't know if he converted. I don't know his biography. But he's using the racist terminology. You see it in the rise of violence on the right, racist violence on the right. I mean, it's there. It's whether it's attacked on Jews or attacks on churches. You're seeing in the rhetoric. I'll just say, when I did a show, 2 years ago on the alt-right, the tweets I got afterwards, you can't imagine that I would see that in America, leaving Israel. The anti-Semitism, the seething hatred, the embracing of Nazi. Granted, that's a little group on the right, but the fact that nobody will criticize them, that the right doesn't expel them, that they're not being, is all a part of this. And I think it's there all over the place. It's the way people talk about immigrants. And you know, there's a strong emphasis of xenophobia and racism that is associated with it. Otherwise, it's not explainable, because none of the issues that they raise are real issues, or where they haven't been real arguments about. So, you know, I hate to say it. I hate to say it, because it's not what I came to America partially to escape tribalism, right? I hated it. I hated Israel because of its tribalism. I don't hate Israel, but my resentment towards Israel was the tribalism in Israel. And over the last 3 years, I've seen the rise of tribalism and racism in America in ways that I never imagined could happen again. And of course, as Greg said, the racism, there's a history here that has resurfaced. So I don't think it's out of nowhere. I mean, I think there are a lot of examples. I've just come up with what hit me first, but there are a lot of examples out there.
So we're basically at time. If you can stay for one more minute, is that okay with everyone? I'm going to ask you each in two sentences, what do you see as a path towards reclaiming Americanism? And you can say by the book, but that's one sentence. You need one more.
Ayn Rand, I think, laid the path for us. It's about speaking. It's about educating. So first and foremost, thank you for your support of the Institute. I encourage you to continue to do that to help make these projects possible and to get them in the hands of the students who are going to determine the course of this country.
Embrace radicalism. Embrace that we are radical. We're fundamentally deeply different than any other set of ideas out there. And that makes us alone and it makes us small, but it's the only way we're going to win is if we embrace that and fight for that. And don't dilute it, don't water it down, don't compromise, don't think you're going to win the short-term battle and sacrifice, because you're sacrificing everything by doing that. It's we got to accept the fact that we're alone and we've got to and fight. That was more than two sentences.
Okay, I'll try to get it as two sentences, which is give people a positive, and then with the theme of the conference, get Atlas Shrugged into the hands of any good person you meet.
One sentence from Ayn Rand and one, so a little bit explaining it. The strike you have to go on is cultural. That's what she said when asked, how does the principle of the strike apply in her time? Should we go on strike? I gave a whole talk on this 2 years ago, applying the striker's principles in America today. The strike you have to go on is cultural. And what that means concretely is we have this idea of a walk away movement, people leaving the Democratic Party. You need a walk away movement from the Democratic Party, from the Republican Party, from the left, from the right, from all of these institutions, all of these groups that are part of the mainstream culture, a recognition that they're corrupt and bad, and that we need something else. And then we need, what is that something else? And that something else is America and objectivism. And again, with Ankar, the giving Atlas Shrugged and the helping people to see what it is. They're not diluting its message by making it seem like some minor variant on some stale tribal bromide, but they're recognizing that it's about loving your own life, achieving your own happiness, and fighting for the kind of society that allows for it. And it's a slow, long, uphill battle, but to quote the Romantic Manifesto, those of us who fight for the future live in it today.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.